In Chicago today, the Trinity United Church of Christ held its first Sunday services in 20 years without Barack Obama as a member. Obama's faced months of criticism for his association with Trinity's controversial former pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. The senator quit the church on Friday after a recent incident in which a visiting priest gave a sermon mocking Senator Hillary Clinton. Obama's decision left some in the Trinity congregation surprised and disappointed. But as Chicago Public Radio's Sam Hudzik reports, there's no anger directed at Obama himself.
At the 7 a.m. service, Barack Obama's name was not spoken from the altar, but there were several indirect references to the controversy that's rocked the church in recent months. Speaking from the pulpit, an assistant pastor urged the crowd of about 2,500 parishioners to forget the news media. One parishioner this morning flatly blamed the media for making the senator feel so uncomfortable with the church he had to quit. But Fred Pope didn't see it that way.
He's a strong man. No one can force you. Again, the bottom line, if he stops serving God, then that would be a problem for me. He can go wherever he chooses to go.
That sentiment of understanding was shared by many of the churchgoers this morning, including a woman who identified herself as Miss Lemon.
I guess he's doing what he feels that he has to do.
Do you think it's what he had to do?
Well, I don't think he had to do it, but that was his decision. And I stick by his decision.
Lemon says some in the congregation may be upset by Obama's decision to leave Trinity, but she says despite his celebrity, the senator has never been the focal point of church services.
I don't believe there was too much mention of Senator Obama in the first place, except for the praises that...
Stay away from the media.
She's interrupted here when a woman leans out her car window and scolds her for talking to a reporter. Lemon shrugs it off, but you can't blame some in the congregation for feeling besieged by the media. Their church's name has become a political lightning rod, and this morning four camera crews and a half dozen reporters gathered outside. But there's a sense that normalcy might soon return to Trinity. On his way to the 11 o'clock service, one man asked for his thoughts on Obama's resignation, replied, "I'm thinking about meeting God." For NPR News, I'm Sam Hudzik in Chicago.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Barack Obama has resigned his membership in the Trinity Memorial Church in Chicago after a second embarrassing incident with a minister in the church. Obama had attended the church over the past 20 years. Joining us to discuss that development is NPR's Don Gagne. Don, hello.
Hey, guy.
So this is the church of the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. His sermons caused so much trouble for Senator Obama up to now, of course.
Exactly. It's United Church of Christ. It's in Chicago. He's the now retired Reverend Jeremiah Wright, but the problems with the affiliation with his church continue for Senator Obama. And the latest thing being a videotape that emerged this past week of a recent sermon just a week ago. It was a guest sermon by a Catholic priest, Father Michael Flager, who is a white Catholic priest in Chicago, but who delivered a very racially charged sermon in support of Barack Obama. But in it, he really, in very theatrical style, mocked Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. And it was a speech that Barack Obama condemned this past week. And now we find out that he's been mulling the notion of actually leaving the church, a church he's been a member of for 20 years, and he has submitted a formal letter of resignation withdrawing from the church today.
Don, with all of this out there so long, why tonight?
Well, I think it is just a question of it finally kind of, dawning on them that the affiliation is something that has to stop here. And clearly, this is a church that he has defended. We heard his speech on race back in April, where he talked about how important the church was, how he has, then and since in even more stronger language, denounced some of the statements that we have heard from Reverend Jeremiah Wright. But it is a community that Senator Obama has talked about how much good it has done helping the poor, and that he has been proud to be a member of. He has also said that he was not present when any of these inflammatory things that have really been circulating around the internet and elsewhere were said. So he has, been deliberating this for a few days, we're told, by the campaign this afternoon. And, you know, they decided to send the letter today, perhaps on the eve of Sunday morning service there tomorrow.
And Don, briefly, are we expecting to hear from the campaign on this?
Yes, we are going to hear formally. I have some of these questions answered by Barack Obama, who is campaigning in South Dakota today in advance of that primary there next Tuesday.
Thank you, Don.
All right.
NPR's Don Gagne speaking with us on the line.
The Texas Supreme Court has upheld a lower court's ruling that children from a polygamist ranch in that state should not have been removed from their homes. More than 400 children were taken into protective custody this spring after Texas officials raided the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The state claimed it had seized more than a dozen pregnant underage teens. Yesterday, the Texas High Court said that the state went too far when it removed all of the children. NPR's Wade Goodwin has been covering this story since the beginning, and he joins us now. Good morning, Wade.
Good morning.
So what did this ruling say? Does the state of Texas have to return all the children? Can they keep some of the children?
What the Supreme Court ruled is that it felt there was not enough evidence to support removing all of the children. So I think that's the main signal they wanted to send to the state judge, Barbara Walther, in San Angelo, that she went too far and that the boys and prepubescent girls should be returned. But the court essentially punted back to the trial judge the issue of what to do with the FLDS girls who might be vulnerable to sexual abuse. Here's a key passage of the ruling. Quote, while the district court must vacate the current temporary custody orders, it need not do so without granting other appropriate relief to protect the children. Well, there's wiggle room there. The Supreme Court doesn't like the trial judge's decision to take all the children, but the court seems to be open to the state seizing some of the children if the evidence supports it.
Well, we know from your reporting that this Judge Walther is quite a character, I will say. Do we know what she's going to do?
That's a good question. I think the court's ruling means that most, if not all, of the boys and the young girls, the prepubescent girls, are going to go back to their parents. But what about the girls who are 11, 12, 13, 14 years old? That's still going to be up to Walther. Now, how she proceeds is anybody's guess. She could say, fine, you don't like the way I'm going about it. All the children can go home. I wash my hands of it. Now it's on your heads. Or she could try to find middle ground. It's up to her.
Well, Texas officials argued that if the children were returned, if they are returned, there's going to be a likelihood that maybe some of these families will move out of state, start a new compound, and then the state of Texas can do nothing.
Well, you know, the FLDS has a history of moving families and children and mothers around from state to state. That was what Texas child welfare officials were concerned, that the children were going to be moved out, the state of Texas would lose any ability to protect the children. I think Judge Walther agreed with that, but the appeals courts dissented. They said if there's no immediate danger, they can't be removed. In other words, Texas can't use past FLDS history to predict future FLDS outcomes. I think that's a ruling that's going to infuriate child welfare advocates around the country.
Well, this is such a loaded topic. I hesitate even bringing this up, but it seems like there's a difference of opinion between the male judges and the female judges here.
This is one of the more interesting dynamics. Out of the 13 state judges who've been involved, Judge Walther, the three appeals court judges, and the 9 Supreme Court judges, 2 are women and 11 are men. The trial judge, a woman, erred on the side of protecting the children. She seized all of them. Then the appeals court, all men, said no to Judge Walther in the state of Texas. They came down on the side of the FLDS parents and against child welfare officials. Then when it got to the Supreme Court, the court split. 5 of the men sided with the FLDS parents, but Judge O'Neill, the one woman, dissented. She wanted the court to stipulate that the pubescent girls should be removed for their own protection, and she was able to get 2 male colleagues to agree with her, but she couldn't get a majority. So that issue is going to go back to the trial judge. A woman will be the final decider.
NPR's Wade Goodwin will be covering this case for some time, I imagine. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Noah Adams. Today we bring you our second story about polygamy among some Muslims in America. It is illegal in all 50 states for a man to have multiple wives, but some Muslim immigrants still secretly take on 2, 3, and even 4 wives. In yesterday's story, we focused on those wives like Sarah. In her experience and many others, husbands marry again without their consent.
He say, okay, I'm going to be married tomorrow. Or he say, I'm going to be married today. It happened to me. I can't talk.
Today, our story focuses on Muslim women in plural marriages who are U.S.-born. Polygamy is growing quickly among African-American Muslims, particularly in the inner city. Many of these women say they choose such arrangements because there aren't a lot of eligible black men. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty has this story about two polygamous families in Philadelphia.
Even on Saturday morning, there is no rest for Zaki and Mecca, who own and manage 25 properties in Philadelphia.
Did you talk to Abdul Razak about that water bill?
Yes, he should be taking care of it. I'll call him today just because something has to be wrong with that.
The young African-American couple was married just out of high school. 12 years later, they have a son and their own real estate business. The family also has something else, a second wife. 2 years ago, Mecca told her husband she wanted to study Arabic in the Middle East, which meant a lot of time away from home.
First thing that came to my mind was, I'm going to have to find you another wife.
Zaki was game. After all, he had been raised in a polygamous home. Like many African-American Muslims, his father subscribed to an orthodox view of Islam that allows a man to marry several women. Zaki says he loved having 7 siblings and 4 mothers.
I would find out who's making what that particular night. So I know, okay, my other mom made barbecue chicken better than my other mom made fried chicken. So I'm going to go where the barbecue chicken is at. So things of that nature.
Mecca rolls her eyes, her beige headscarf framing her delicate features. NPR is not using any full names in this story because some of those we interviewed could be prosecuted for bigamy. Unlike Zaki, Mecca was raised by a single mother and converted from Southern Baptist to Muslim when she was 16. When it came to finding a second wife, Zaki asked Mecca to conduct the search.
You know, he kind of gave me the baton and I took it and ran with it.
Mecca launched a nationwide search. She found candidates by word of mouth. She scoured the internet and interviewed about a dozen women.
I had to make sure that whoever she was going to be, that she's going to be the right fit, not just for my husband, but for our whole family.
But the ultimate match was right under their noses, 20-year-old Amina, who was a friend of Zaki's younger sister. Amina knew Mecca was looking for a second wife, but thought she was too young, until one night after a dinner party when Mecca pulled her aside.
I said, well, would you consider Zaki as far as for a husband?
And what did you say?
That's what you said. That's what I said. I said, you know, that's funny, because I thought the same thing.
I was basically the last one to know about the whole arrangement.
But Zaki was delighted, and in October, he and Amina married in a religious ceremony. Amina recalls that Mecca was there, helping prepare the wedding feast.
Mecca brought me this cake from Tiffany's. It was a strawberry shortcake with, like, whipped cream and stuff, and she knew I loved this cake. And right afterwards, she gave me that cake, and I was like, I was cool. I was done. I was ready to go home with my cake.
Amina, who's finishing college, lives in an apartment a few miles away from Mecca's house. Zaki moves between homes on alternate nights. But every week after Friday prayers, Mecca says they get together as a family.
Well, I always call it family date night, because it's like we always, it's just one big date. We just chill.
It can be a variety of things, like going to a nice restaurant, catching a movie, going bowling, maybe seeing a concert, all kind of things.
Yes, I'm going upstairs.
But on this day, Zaki's attention is on Amina.
Right now I'm going to the penthouse and I'm going to get dressed for our day, a day that my wife has no clue what she's going to be doing today.
It's Amina's 21st birthday. They're taking the train to New York to see a Broadway show. While Zaki's second wife is changing, his first wife is getting the train tickets and making the arrangements.
See, it gotta work as one unit. It would be really inconvenient otherwise. Hurry up!
No! No, wait!
As he hurries Amina along, Zaki says he will do something equivalent for Mecca on her birthday. Islam requires that the husband treat each wife equally. Zaki explains that does not mean he gives them the same things. For example, Mecca likes jewelry, but Amina does not. But, he says,
if I upgrade one, then you have to upgrade another. Right. But the upgrade don't necessarily is the same because we have two different women with two different tastes.
Of course, there have been a few bumps in the road.
But as far as me second-guessing me sharing my husband, no.
As Mecca speaks, Amina nods in agreement.
I might have certain feelings as far as when my husband walks out the door, and I might not have seen him all day, but his responsibility is not only to me. And the respect that I have for my co-wife, I think all of that plays a role in how I handle my emotions.
And Zaki believes ultimately polygamy is good for society, especially in the inner city, where intact families are rare and many kids grow up without their fathers.
There's a lot of blessings in it because, you know, you're doing something, you know, you're helping legitimize and build a family that's rooted in all values and commitment, you know what I mean? And the children that comes out of those type of relationships only becomes, you know, a benefit to the society at large.
Allahu Akbar, Allah. The imam's voice blares through the PA system of a mosque in South Philadelphia. The congregation gathered in the slim townhouse is largely black. The rules are orthodox, with men and women in separate rooms, and the Arabic is classical. The imam, a 35-year-old convert named Abdullah, has conducted religious ceremonies for about a dozen polygamous marriages. No one knows exactly how many people live in polygamous families in the United States, but estimates range from 50 to 100,000. Abdullah says polygamy in Islam dates back to the 7th century, when battles were killing off Muslim men and leaving widows and children unprotected. As a result, Abdullah says, the Quran specifies that a man may marry, quote, women of your choice, 2, 3, 4, and if you fear you cannot be just, then marry one.
And so a lot of scholars look at it sequentially, like 2 is optimum, then 3, then 4, then as a last resort, then 1.
And while polygamy may seem like a man's paradise, he says, often a single woman initiates it.
Sometimes a woman may want a man, may be interested in a man, but he's off limits. That's not the case in Islam. Well, does he have 4 wives? No, well, it's still an option. He still may be available.
That's how Abdullah met his second wife. A divorcee, she heard Abdullah preach a few times and approached his wife. Soon they married, and now the imam cares for 2 families, a total of 13 children and 1 on the way. On the other side of the mosque, the single women say polygamy is a fact of life, but it's not their first choice.
Every woman would have a preference to be the sole wife.
That's Aaliyah, a 28-year-old single woman who's finishing up a master's degree. She says that South Philadelphia in the 21st century is a little like Arabia in the 7th. There's a dearth of appropriate men.
We're dealing with brothers who are incarcerated, unavailable. And then unfortunately, you have the AIDS and HIV crisis, where HIV has struck the African-American community disproportionately than to others. So when we look at it that way, there is a shortage.
With this numerical advantage, of course, some men collect wives for the sex. Everyone admits that. But the men we interviewed also married out of altruism. Consider 43-year-old Shahid and his second wife, Nadira. They would only meet me outside of their home, and the first wife did not join them. 14 years ago, when Nadira was 30 and expecting her 3rd child, her husband died. That brought her to the attention of Shahid.
Her husband and I were friends, so when I came to the gravesite, actually, I remember like it was yesterday, what stuck out was that her demeanor was so calm.
Nadira is an elegant, contained woman. Once a widow, she decided the only way she'd marry again was as a second wife.
Because at that point in my life, I was used to being alone as opposed to constantly being with someone and, you know, attending to someone else's needs.
She accepted Shahid's proposal, but she quickly saw the tricky relationship was not with Shahid, it was with his wife.
We met and we had dinner and we had lunch and we went out and shopped and did different things at that point. As the marriage got closer, I think that she was more apprehensive and more unnerved by the pending situation.
I remember me just telling him, please don't go. I was like, what do you mean? The wedding is today. How are you telling me not to go today? I'm like, just don't go.
That's Aaliyah, the first wife. She agreed to talk with me a week later. Before the marriage, Aaliyah, who is 40, considered Shahid's commitment to a widow, quote, noble. Afterwards, she considered divorce, but eventually decided she did not want to start over. After 2 years of misery, Aaliyah says she had a spiritual epiphany.
I just got up one morning and said, okay, this is what you want me to do. I'm going to handle it in a civil manner, and I'm going to do X, Y, Z about it. And from that point on, it was the stranger thing because it never bothered me anymore. I never even thought about it. It was just, we're all together.
The family began to operate like a well-oiled machine and a model of polygamy in their Muslim community. Shahid runs his own security company. Aliyah teaches first grade and Nadira homeschools the children.
We really depend on each other. It was like, I guess, a cross between a sister and a friend and a coworker and just like other areas where you're able to have a cushion or a help in areas that you didn't have before.
At first, the two families lived in separate homes. Now Shahid, his two wives, and 9 of his 10 children live in one house. Each wife has a bedroom on a separate floor, but everything else is communal, including cooking and eating. Shahid says it's not easy to treat his two very different wives equally, but he tries.
I'm not going to be overly affectionate with this one as opposed to this one with regards to in the open.
But what about his heart?
That's something that you can't really control, but materially you want to do that as adequately as possible.
First wife Aliyah is philosophical.
You cannot blame someone for where their heart lies.
Did you have a sense which way his heart was going?
At the time, really, it didn't matter. I just knew that he had someone else in his life, and it wasn't me.
It's painful.
Yeah.
Aliyah says polygamy is not easy for either wife, though she believes it's harder on the first.
The second wife is receiving something where a first wife will feel something is being taken away from her. I mean, I'm devoted to you for my whole life, but then you're only devoted to half of my life.
Aliyah's youngest is 4 years old, which means she has many more years of polygamous family life. Her oldest, a 17-year-old daughter, says she's had a happy childhood, but she hopes she won't have to share her husband with anyone else. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
And you can hear the first story in our series on Muslim polygamy at npr.org.